This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everyone. And let's jump right into our regular week in review. Big excitement this week around Pope Francis's first visit to the U.S. We'll talk about that. Growing concern about sexual assault on college campuses and horrific revelations in the tragic case of 2-year-old Bella Bond, allegedly killed by her mother's boyfriend, Michael McCarthy.
She went to her daughter and picked her up, and she told police that she knew at that moment that her daughter was dead. She asked Mr. McCarthy what he had done, and he did not tell her, but he said she was a demon anyway. It was her time to die.
As we know, after a jogger found Bella Bond's body in a garbage bag on Deer Island back in June, police searched tirelessly for a lead and finally received a tip from a family friend that cracked the case. Prosecutors charged Bella's mother, Rochelle, with accessory after the fact and Michael McCarthy with murder. But why didn't someone come forward sooner? And what does this case say about the state of child welfare in Massachusetts? Joining us now to talk about that and the rest of the week's news is Arlene Isaacson. She's political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. And Arlene, good to have you back on Radio Boston.
Thank you. Same here.
Also with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and writer for Politico, WBUR's Cognoscenti's Ideas and Opinion page, and the Boston Globe. Great to have you, Tom.
Pleasure to be here.
Always good to have you back. So let's talk about the Bella Bond case. And Tom, let's start with you. Where does the responsibility for this terrible situation lie? DCF, government, neighbors, her parents, all of the above?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely has to start with the mother and the boyfriend, right? I mean, that's really where the responsibility is. I think the problem with the finger pointing here, and clearly everyone's going to want to point fingers at DCF, is that we demand of DCF at this point near perfection. I mean, I'll remind you that just a year ago, we were all upset at DCF when it was taking away children that everyone thought should not be taken away from the parents. And so it has this incredible problem, this incredible public relations problem. Nothing it does is right. And, you know, there were a few things out there that really bothered me. One of them apparently being that if a couple of children are taken away, then it isn't sort of automatically a kind of presumption that maybe the third should be taken away. That clearly is something to take a look at. But I do think, you know, Baker's going through a real review of what's going on at DCF, and I think maybe a top-to-bottom review of policies and how children are handled. But I'm going to be a little bit hesitant about pointing fingers at this point.
All right. Well, Arlene, I want to come to you, but just to sort of jump off on Tom's point, let's talk about, whether we should be pointing a finger at DCF. Some people would say, look, Bella's mother, Rochelle Bond, lost custody of her two older children. DCF was involved twice before. Rochelle Bond had a lengthy criminal record dating back to 1999 that included a whole bunch of things, including drug possession and prostitution. Michael McCarthy, the alleged killer, also had a criminal record. I mean, if that didn't, like, send up red flags to DCF, what would have?
Well, you know, you raise a good point, but I think that sometimes it might be time to start taking a 30,000-foot view of the issue. And when I've done that, here's what I keep thinking, that we see these stories crop up every few years, if not every year. They happen under every governor of both parties. And every time they happen, DCF is criticized or whatever the agency is called in. Every time it happens, the funding is reexamined and deemed to be underfunded. Every time it happens, we say social workers are overwhelmed, understaffed, inadequately credentialed or supervised. You know, you get what you pay for. And when you're dealing with burned out, overworked social workers with too many cases to oversee adequately, I don't know what we expect. To me, this takes us to a place where there's a hard political truth that no one has talked about yet, but it underlies all of this, which is proper staffing and oversight takes money. We have a structural deficit in this state, so to adequately fund these important services, you need to raise taxes. And I think the real problem here is that good people who care deeply about this story and are touched by it and want the services provided to these kids, sometimes those people say, I don't want my taxes raised. And hopefully, they'll begin to realize that when you have a structural deficit, you can't have the funding for these important programs without the taxes.
What do you think, Tom? I mean, is this a case of folks demanding, you know, great public services, but not always being willing to pay for them?
So I'm not persuaded it's a revenue issue entirely. DCF actually has had its budget increased, I think, over the last year. But the problem seems to be more to be structural, and that is, you know, you raise a great point. I mean, these look on paper like terrible parents. Of course there were red flags raised, but we also have a policy in place of trying to preserve families as much as possible. We don't prejudge, even though the previous two kids were taken away. And I do think that this we will probably find that this was not a case of overwhelmed social workers, but rather a case where our policy did not allow us to take away a child who should have been taken away.
You know, I don't think it could be a structural problem, because if it were, this wouldn't keep happening year after year with every single governor, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats, liberals, progressives, with brilliant people that they appoint to run those agencies, and it keeps happening it again and again. They change the structure, they redo the policies. I don't think there is a silver bullet perfect policy. What we do need are... This may not have been solved by more social workers or social workers with fewer caseloads, lesser caseloads, but it sure will help the next child in the situation.
Yeah, and I think my point more is what I started off with, which is that by structural, I mean that it's impossible to get it right every single time. And when we don't get it right, it's really bad.
Yeah. You guys make some great points. I want to sort of bring this conversation back to a really fundamental idea that was sort of raised by Kevin Cullen, columnist for the Boston Globe. He wrote about this story very well last week. The headline of his story was, "How Hard Could It Have Been to Make an Anonymous Call?" Here's what he told us on Radio Boston.
You know, I talked to some of the neighbors, and there are two things that they almost all said. They were frightened by the people, the men, the stream of men that used to go to Rochelle Bond's apartment, and that she herself, they described her as appearing to be under the influence of drugs regularly, and that they just were afraid of these people, and they didn't want anything to do with them.
And so the big question that he raises is sort of the responsibility of neighbors, and how hard could it have been to make an anonymous call? And I want to just ask you both about that, because it seems like a basic and fair question to ask, but it's easy to blame neighbors for not dropping a dime. On the other hand, seems like there's a conflict in this country. We value privacy enormously. We want government out of our lives. There's sort of an understandable reluctance for folks to get involved with other people's business. I don't know. What do you think, Tom?
Remember Kitty Genovese, the case
exactly.
In New York? I think it was in the 60s. A woman is being assaulted and ultimately, I think, killed on the streets. And the neighbors are watching it and don't call the police at that time. And I do think that this continues to be a reflection of that. We've got, you know, in the digital age, we have incredible social networks. And we all apparently care for each other in those, or maybe not. But we don't really have networks on the street, house to house. And I think that's a reflection of that. People would just as soon go about their business and not get involved in someone else's life.
Yeah. I think you know, Tom, unlike the Kitty Genovese story, which so many of us who lived through it remember, there you saw the crime being committed in front of your very eyes and did nothing. Here, they didn't see it. The question is, could they imagine it? Did they assume it? Or did they assume Bella went somewhere else, was sent to another family member? And that's a tougher hurdle. But Kevin is right. They could have picked up the phone and made a call.
Yeah. Although, eventually, someone did pick up the phone.
It's true.
That's the point.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the pieces you really have to give some praise here to is to the investigators who were involved in this one.
Absolutely.
To the ability to create a picture that looks so much like she really did, to the incredible effort that was spent by the police and investigators in following down every single lead here. I mean, if you know, we look at it and we say, boy, people really don't think human life matters, and there is that element of it. But there were clearly a bunch of people here who really thought human life did matter, and that was the cops and the other investigators.
All right, well, we should move on. I want to talk about the visit of Pope Francis to the U.S., not exactly a local story, but obviously one that just about everyone around town has been following. Today, Francis is in New York City, where he spoke to the U.N. Tomorrow, he'll head to Philadelphia. Yesterday, he addressed a joint session of Congress, the first pope in history to do that. He spoke about immigration, the death penalty, and climate change. Here's a bit of what he said.
I call for a courageous and responsible effort to redirect our steps and to avert the most serious effects of the environmental deterioration caused by human activity. I'm convinced that we can make a difference. I'm sure.
Arlene, I'd love to get your reaction to this, Pope. He waded into some issues that are controversial on Capitol Hill, talking about abolition of the death penalty, global warming, social justice, a whole bunch of issues. What did you think?
Well, it was very interesting. You know, on the one hand, watching him lecture Congress on compassion and responsibility was a wonderful thing to behold. It was interesting to see how Democrats and Republicans each took away something different from his remarks. Oh, he supported us. No, he supported us. In both cases, it seems they were inspired to try and listen to, as Lincoln said, the better angels of themselves. But I haven't heard Lincoln quoted so much as in the about the better angels in the last 24 hours as I have ever. So the question is, will it stick? Because I believe people really were inspired. And if it doesn't stick with these members of Congress, we're going to have to remind ourselves and them of the moments when his words touched us to aspire to our better angels. And I actually believe that sometimes the act of reminding people to be their better selves can actually cause them to do so.
Hmm. What did you think, Tom? Because we asked the same question to a couple of members of Congress yesterday. You know, a lot of folks were inspired. Is it going to make a difference in the long run, especially in an institution that is so paralyzed by legislative impasse?
Well, if you're simply talking about his address to Congress, I think that they hear a lot of stuff and it can kind of roll over their, you know, roll off their shoulders. I think what's extraordinary about Francis's visit is that he's not just touching members of Congress, but is really reaching out to a national audience. And it is an audience that has really been following this over the last couple of days, and I think will for the next two. Obviously he's the leader of Roman Catholics around the world, and so there is that religious aspect. And yet his message here is clearly a very secular message. Mm-hmm. And it really is amazing, and I think incredibly gratifying, that every once in a while, perhaps, we take some time off to sit back and contemplate sort of the ethics and morality of what we are doing. And I don't know of anyone else who could make an entire nation do that, but he seems to be doing that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when we did a conversation with James Carroll, among other folks, about the Pope's visit, I was struck by the folks who called, because we had some Catholics who called, but I think we had more callers who basically began their comments by saying something like, I'm not Catholic, but I've got to say, I am blown away by what this guy is, the message that he's delivering, and I just found that interesting.
And, you know, some of the things, some of the effect he's had isn't so much through his words, but it's through his deeds. Mm. The fact that he would pass over a gourmet lunch with elected officials in Congress and instead go to a homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. That speaks 1,000 words.
Yeah, symbols matter. On the other hand, we spoke this week to David O'Regan. He's a survivor of clergy sex abuse, the director of the New England chapter of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. He told us that people like him are still waiting for real church accountability on this issue, so it's been tough for him to watch this visit. Here's what he said.
We have been horribly wounded and hurt. You know, we look at the church and we look especially towards the Pope in a much different way.
We also brought this up with author James Carroll about this issue, who says this wound will take a very long time to heal, to repair. Here's James Carroll.
Frankly, it would be surprising to me if within a couple of years the Pope could repair that. He can't repair it quickly. This is a savage break in the moral meaning of Catholic Christianity, but he has established structures, mechanisms of accountability that I think are going to work.
Obviously, this issue resonates in Boston, which is sort of ground zero of the clergy sex abuse scandal. But Arlene, what's your response to this? I mean, is James Carroll right? Are those mechanisms enough? Are we going to fix? Is the church going to be able to fix this this breakdown, I guess, in credibility?
Well, given the damage that was done to so many for so long, they've got miles to go before they rest. But at least he's moving in the right direction. But the survivors are right to be, the survivors and their families are right to be demanding still more, still faster, still deeper in the changes that are made.
Yeah. Final thought from you, Tom.
I can't disagree. I mean, I think Carol's right, which is that this is a wound that is so deep that you cannot fix this in a year or two. I do think that this particular Pope gets it. And I think the process, I certainly do think that on a going forward basis, you're not going to see this ever happen again. There's still a lot of damage to repair for the past. And a lot of people have left the church over it, too.
Yeah. All right, well, let's move on and talk about a new student survey, one of the largest of its kind, on sexual assault on college campuses. The Association of American Universities found that nearly a quarter of undergraduate women, one quarter, one in four, say they've been victims of sexual assault or misconduct since entering college. The numbers vary somewhat school to school. At Harvard, for example, it's slightly more than one in four women who say they've experienced unwanted sexual conduct. We spoke to Colby Bruno. She's senior legal counsel of the Victim Rights Law Center about this week. Here's what she said.
I don't think that anybody looking at any of this data, even if you're talking about plus or minus 5%, would suggest that we don't have a national problem. I think it's very clear that we do, not just based on the AAU, but based on all the other previous studies that have gone on.
So, Tom, what's your take on this? Colby Bruno calls it a national problem. I couldn't imagine anyone who would deny that, but do we have the structures in place to address it?
We do not have the structures in place to address it, clearly, because if we did, we wouldn't be having this kind of problem. I think it does come down to an issue of respect for other people. And I'd love to see teased out what are the causes of such abuse and disrespect. And it really is disrespect of seeing other people, and particularly women, as objects rather than people. And I don't know what to account for it. I mean, is it a phenomenon of sort of the hookup culture that's now so pervasive in college? Is it a phenomenon of competition among males who seem sort of unleashed from normal, you know, structures that hold them back? I don't know what it is, but clearly it's an issue. There's no question. I mean, when you get surveys like this across the board with this level of response, the point's right. I mean, it could be plus or minus 5%, but it's not zero.
Right, of course. Arlene, what's your take on
this? Well, my daughters always think that I'm overprotective, and they probably are right, but these numbers are profoundly troubling. And worse still are the numbers about trans and gender nonconforming students. I think these figures were that 75% of LGBT students were sexually harassed, and the assault numbers were the highest for the trans and gender nonconforming students. So it's a serious problem. There's sort of a good news and bad news in there for me. The good news was that they said that over half of the kids who reported the assaults to the proper authorities felt that their experience was a good one, however they were treated or whatever the investigation was. And that's terrific, but it's only half. The bad news to me is that so many students who witnessed an incapacitated, aka a drunk student, heading for a sexual encounter did nothing to intervene to their friends. And that's something that speaks to the culture change, part of the culture change that's needed.
So here's my big question, and I'm thinking back to, so I went to college, and I mean, I'll give it away, I went to college in the late 70s. You know, since then, is it getting worse, or are we simply more aware of a problem? I mean, this is what I wonder about.
That is a great question. And you do have to wonder. I mean, you know, at one point, for example, the rape statistics started to change, and it appeared there were more rapes, but it really looked like what was actually going on is people were finally willing to report rapes were occurring. And I don't know if this is something that – this may be better than it used to be. Maybe it was 50%. And yet there's really a part of me that thinks that this is probably worse, even though I have nothing – to base that on.
Yeah. What about you, Arlene? Do you have a sense about that?
It was so unreported in the past that Tom could be right about it, but my sense is that there's a freedom of, that both the incapacitation issue is a bigger problem now, but also there's a disinclination for people to think it matters all that much.
Well, clearly a big problem. It's certainly one that a lot of folks are paying attention to, so let's hope progress will be made on this. So we have just enough time here now for our hubbubs, those very brief stories that might not have trended on Twitter, fell below the fold, but certainly caught the attention of our panel. Arlene, let me start with you.
Well, I love the story about the public art on the side of the Hancock Tower. It's the latest in a series of public art that, in my opinion, makes our lives richer, more interesting. I'm real appreciative of it, and hopefully it gives everyone one more reason to look up from their handheld devices when they walk down the street.
And what's there? Can you remind us?
They have projected onto the side of the Hancock Tower a picture of a man looking out into the distance.
Nice. All right. Tom, how about your hubbub?
Well, this is not art at all. This is about crime and punishment. So here's the problem with crime and punishment in America. We call our prisons correctional institutions, but even when folks are supposed to get corrected, even if they see the light to becoming upright members of society, we seem bent on stymieing them once they get out of jail. And the examples are legion, such as background checks that prevent people from getting jobs, mandatory prison sentences, and here in Massachusetts, the fact that those convicted of drug-related crimes get their driver's licenses suspended. The result? They can't get jobs that might involve them commuting or, say, becoming a pizza delivery person. If this rule applied to just those who are high when they were driving, that might make sense. But it doesn't. It applies to all. So in a welcome moment of sanity, the state Senate has just passed legislation to overturn this rule. The House remains noncommittal. Governor Baker's offered some qualified support. They both need to get on board. This is the first of what I hope would be a significant new rethinking of how we reintegrate ex-cons into society rather than pushing them back into a life of crime.
All right. Interesting. That's a good one and an important issue. So my hubbub is a little bit lighter. It comes from, I've got to credit Globe reporter Beth Tytel, who reported it this week about a new health and fitness club that's being planned on Nantucket. Did you guys read about this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so this club will have an initiation fee of $120,000. It'll cost a mere $5,000 a year, but I did a little math based on Beth's reporting. So initiation fee plus first-year fees comes to $125,000. Let's say, optimistically, you get to the gym three times a week, roughly 150 times a year. It comes to about $830 a visit for that first year. So as Beth wrote, talk about feeling guilty when you don't go to the gym. Of course, that figure is amortized over time, but still, 120 grand for an initiation.
At that rate, the riffraff will get in.
Unbelievable. Okay, that's it there. I'll leave it there. $125,000. So, Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus and a political consultant, thank you for coming and have a great week.
Thank you.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, thank you as well. It's always a pleasure to have you, Tom, and I wish you both a great weekend.
Yeah, you as well.
All right. Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, at what point is an addict unfit to be a parent? We're going to talk about that in the wake of the Bella Bond case. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.